Blog Talk Radio.
That's the latest from Jim Bass Night on this KBOX Seattle Double Play Weekend. Remember, we're out at the Green Lake Aqua Theater with record giveaways and free details from your favorite radio station, along with the Dynamics, the Sonics, and the Wailers. It's summer in the Jet City, so come on, let's rock and roll with Jim.
I don't mind if you walk out that door.
To welcome everyone to John Talk Radio's Independent Music Showcase. This is July the 17th, 2019. We started this adventure in November of 2008, interviewing independent artists from all over the globe just because I love music. I love talking to people that make music, and above all, I love good music. And my guest tonight is Jim Bassnight. Jim, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here, John. Thanks a lot for having me.
Oh, it's awesome to have you on. People have asked me, I've been known to play just so many different genres of music that it kind of freaks some of my friends out a little bit because it doesn't seem like I land in one area. But if I'm going to say I've landed in one area more than another, it would be garage rock. I just love it. I love everything about it. And, you know, some people call it power pop or just rock and roll. But we want to just explore that with you tonight. Jim Bassnight's new album is called Not Changing, and his website is jimbassnightmusic.com. Did I get that right?
Yes, that's right. jimbassnightmusic.com.
Yep. And I think that's always good to get that out there because I'll have people ask me, how can I get the music? We've got a lot to talk about because I want to talk about you've been in the music industry for a while. You've recorded, you've had record contracts, you've been in the ground floor of a lot of things that are going on. I truly, yeah, and I've seen it myself. I've also, Jim, I've seen it going from, you know, the AM radio where I would listen to a song when I was growing up, and I would hear a song and I would freak out. It was so good, but I just had to wait till it came back on again and have my little transistor, and I would listen to it, like if I wanted to hear, you know, a Beatles song or an Animal song or the Supremes or anything. It wasn't like
right.
now where it's on demand. It was so
sure.
it was you cherished it. I mean, it was like when the song would come
yeah.
on, you would like freak out because it was so cool. What's Jim Bassnight
yep.
think about the way things are now? I mean, you've adapted, you have to survive, but now with the industry, the way it is with streaming, with, you know, there are downloads people can buy, there are CDs people can buy, but they can also stream it on all these big streaming sites. And you've seen this. What do you think? And I'm kind of baiting you a little bit because I was just reading Joe Walsh, some stuff he said about it. I don't know if you've read that or seen all the things he says
about that. I didn't read the
yeah.
whole thing, but I heard about it. I'd like to maybe look into more of what he had to say. Joe is a kind of a cool dude, actually. And I kind of ran across him a little bit through my research of Sonny Boy Williamson. He's from Cleveland, and some of his teenage friends, musician associates that he grew up with playing music when he was a teenager, played with Sonny Boy in Cleveland in like 1963. So I talked to a couple of them, and none of whom are real famous. One guy was in a band, actually, that was on a major label at one point. But I figured I'd get a hold of Joe because he was kind of a name guy from that group and see if he knew anything about that Sonny Boy stuff. And he admitted that he really didn't, but he was really gracious and got back to me and was very friendly. So he seems like a really nice guy. He's got a reputation of being kind of a huge partier, kind of a like a
mm-hmm.
like a, you know, stoner or whatever. But he seems like a really cool guy and good guitar player too. So yeah, you know, honestly, to be honest with you about the music business, I mean, it's a real huge topic. I mean, you know, I basically wrote a 450-page biography of this guy, Sonny Boy Williamson, and I worked on that from like January 2012 until January of 2018, basically, but mostly kind of slowed down when my research partner passed away, Bill Donahue, in January of 2017. It was kind of a year of kind of figuring out where to go next with it. But through that process, I got a real unique perspective on the music business. I looked at it and realized that this whole thing is only 100 years old. The first blues-based music put to a disc, something that someone could buy in it or listen to in any form, really, was 100 years ago. It was recorded in 1919. So, and what Sonny Boy kind of taught me and all that research taught me was that there was a whole lot that happened before I jumped on board. It sounds to me like we kind of came on board about the same time from the bands you were naming when you had your transistor radio. But I remember going to see the Beatles movie Help in 1965 with my dad. And that's when I really started getting into music when I was a little kid. And from there on, I was at least interested in it. And I started playing guitar shortly thereafter and learned a Bob Dylan song, Blowing in the Wind, and maybe tried to learn like a song like Gloria or something like that shortly after that. But basically, you know, it just kind of, that was me, and that kind of my whole story is a whole nother topic. But I realized that Sonny Boy died in 1965, and there was a lot of things that happened in the course of his life that kind of came from nowhere to the point where I was at that time in 65. Like, records, first of all, then radio. I mean, the first American roots radio show at all was the Grand Ole Opry down in Nashville. That was in 1927. The first blues radio show was a show that Sonny Boy hosted in Helena, Arkansas, on the Mississippi River, and that was in 1941. And that was also the beginning of electric blues. That was like the first show to feature an electric guitar playing blues based music, and also kit drummer playing blues based music, blues based, basic rock and roll, kind of early pre rock and roll, and Electric Blues. And then you know, just from there, I learned all about jukeboxes and the role that they played, the role that the mafia played in the old early parts of the music business, jukebox business, and the whole, you know, era after Prohibition, just the role that, you know, actually in the South that the Klan played in that. It was just, there's an awful lot of, and actually other places in the country too, but there was an awful lot of, things that happened in the 20s and 30s that really defined the direction of the music business. And then after World War II, it kind of came to a real halt because they couldn't make records because the shellac was all in the Philippines at that time to make 78s, which were the predominant records. And so after World War II, everything just blew up. The first record distribution company that dealt independent American labels, primarily roots, you know, music and gospel and, you know, blues and what they used to call hillbilly and that kind of stuff, it sprung up and down there in the deep South in Memphis. And just from there, the first independent pressing plant, but the same guy that owned that distribution company also got the first pressing plant together that wasn't controlled by a major label. And so all that happened. And then of course the birth of rock and roll, which rose out of this kind of mixture of electric blues and what they now call country. Back then it was kind of considered hillbilly or whatever. The folk music of that region, the Grand Ole Opry and all the stuff that came out of that. So, and then gospel played a huge role in all that too. The gospel musicians were very often the same musicians that played on Saturday night, and they used a lot of the same licks. They just kind of cleaned it up for Sunday morning and whatnot. Yep. And then from that whole sort of amalgam in that region down there in the Memphis, Mississippi, Arkansas, northern East Louisiana region, came this rock and roll, you know, and with Elvis and all that stuff, and you know, all these things happened, and from the rock and roll thing, it blew up, and you know, and then eventually it kind of, they tried to suppress it, and it was actually very political, because it was, you know, it was at a time when the civil rights movement was also really starting to take hold, and it was considered subversive. I mean, the word rock and roll essentially is code language for rocking the boat, which is sort of essentially what integration was considered to be doing, rocking the boat. So there was a lot of, you know, hidden meanings in a lot of the blues and rock and roll songs were kind of, you know, back then very risque. Now we'd consider that there'd be very, you know, very small time, you know, but there was an awful lot that was going on then. And then it kind of came to a sort of a wind down with those, you know, rock and roll was going to die. But then of course the British invasion really blew that up. And Sonny Boy had a lot to do that. He lived there in the last 2 years of his life. And he was like the blues guy that everybody knew and everybody played with, from Clapton to Page to, you know, Rod Stewart to all the basic stars that were big, huge stars when I was a kid in the early 70s and stuff. So, you know, he was a big guy, and it really showed me a lot about just where everything came from up to the point where I did. And I think I took a lot of the energy that gave me, that project, into making this new album. And I decided that I really wasn't going to be concerned about making an album that was like technically perfect. I just wanted something that sounded like it was real, that absolutely no, very, you know, basically just absolutely no, like, you know, synchronized tracks or nothing that was digital in the basing of making that song. Everything was just live and just kind of using modern technology, but doing it on the basis of just everything being as real as possible. And I wrote a ton of songs too. I think writing that book really inspired me to really just have my writing chops up really hard. So I came up with a lot of really good songs in the time frame leading up to actually recording the album too. So the whole thing, I think, inspired me a lot to do this album.
Well, that's really almost exactly what Joe Walsh said, Jim, was it's gotten the soul of the music has left, and it's really sounds great, and it's all digital, and it can sound perfect, but just like you said, it lost the human element. I mean, when those guys, you're talking about guys that I did I've done quite a few series on music genres and things like that. And I had a friend of mine, Jim, ask me once what I knew about the blues. And of course, you know, middle-aged white guy, I'm going to say certain people, but you know, they said, well, you really need to get into what, you know, the blues, how the blues started and what happened in the incredible, the motivation behind a lot of this music. And so I interviewed, Lady Di from, she's from West Virginia. She's an incredible, blues singer. And, when I got to talking to her about it, I mean, it took us a little while, like dancing around, to get to where it really she wanted it to go, was the fact that a lot of the music came out of slavery, and the people that were singing for their lives, and they learned rhythms of using their hammer to get the spikes into the railroad ties so that they wouldn't get beaten, and they would sing so they would get in rhythm. Now, I don't know about you, Jim, but that brought it. I mean, I had heard things before, but I just thought, oh, my goodness. I mean, that's incredible. And then that created what you said, the gospel and spiritual. Okay.
Yeah. I can say more about that. I interviewed a guy who's one of the absolute best experts on the era of Jim Crow. And he had this book called Slavery by Another Name. He basically, you know, showed in real clear terms of very, very well-sourced material that slavery really didn't end after the Civil War. There was a time when there was some thought that it was really going to, you know, that things were really going to change for African-Americans that were previously slaves. And then it really all collapsed in on them after the Reconstruction. And there was a system in a lot of the areas where, especially cotton and other types of crops like that were real dependent on slave labor, you know, that was put in place that was almost virtually the same, just kind of sort of changed around legally and with some slight differences, but with a lot of different laws and practices put in place to legitimately make people, you know, living a lifestyle that was virtually or economically almost identical to slavery. So that lasted really until about 1941, when World War II started, was when it really started unraveling. And then, of course, the rest of the story is, you know, obviously there's a lot of controversy as to whether things are perfect now or not. And that's a whole other story. But basically, it's been sort of, you know, one step forward, two steps back, two steps forward, one step back. And there's been progress, a lot of progress. But that was really when things really changed, where, you know, there was a system down there that was it was down there because that was where the economy was so dependent. But it was also across America where there was a lot of segregation and different, you know, problems for not only African-Americans, but Chinese immigrants experienced a whole lot of very, very serious racial discrimination and you know, human rights abuses, as well as, of course, Native Americans. And, you know, you obviously have that story, which, you know, extended well, you know, into the 20th century. And so the long and short of it was that these people down there, especially in the Delta, you know, they were living that life, and they had a system of survival, and some of it had to do with songs, but the music had to do with their African traditions, that they had a tradition of lifestyle that was unique to their lineage, and quite a bit of it was preserved, even though in America they were forced to abandon real important parts of their musical tradition, like drums. And so they just adapted that and adopted new approaches to their traditions, their oral history, expressed in the song and the rhythm, the music, the feel, and of course the chord changes, the chord progressions, and the scale, we commonly know as the blues scale, and the different scales that were used normally. There's all the musical traditions. So that progressed through into, you know, the beginnings of recorded blues and jazz and such as that, and it had a huge influence, truthfully, on American folk music, country music, really, truthfully, from, you know, was heavily influenced by that tradition, as well as, of course, what we now know as R&B, which was sort of progression up from electric blues, and then soul music, which incorporate even more of the church influence, and so on and so forth, and of course rock and roll, and then of course hip hop. Really is a lot of the same types of traditions, just adapted to different musical applications. I mean, the guitar, the piano were basically, that was the high tech. That was the high tech of our culture prior to digital technology. And frankly, I'll say this, that the guitar and the piano were invented by very smart people that, you know, may or may not have understood how to operate a remote control for a TV set, but had tremendous technological understanding of music, and were able to create tools that I think are much better suited to really bringing out the gift that human beings have, that are unique to humans, that we can produce a song. And I think those instruments are actually better suited to producing a song than the digital technology that's available today. I think that's part of the reason why songs have really gone out the window. But I mean, that just means that, you know, 20 years down the line in this digital technology, there's still a lot of room to go. So I'm not downing digital technology. I just think it's, you know, that there just needs to be more attention paid from people that develop it to find new tools that are more able to work with what humans have naturally to create song.
Yeah, you hit some great subjects there. I had the privilege several times to interview Charles Wright of the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band. He's one of the coolest guys you'd ever meet in your life. And when I started, we were doing a prep for our interview, Jim, he said, well, John, the first show or the first couple of shows, we're not going to talk music. And I said, okay. And we talked about sharecropping. And he grew up on a farm with sharecropping. And wow. It was incredible how he went, his family went from absolutely nothing. And he decided, you know, after working so hard with his dad and then he would explain some of the things, Jim, that would go on where, you know, they wouldn't get paid or they'd get paid very little, and they would do the work for other people. And finally, he just said, I gotta go. So he went to Los Angeles, and he was such a talented. Oh, he still is. He's got an album now. I think he had 2 years old, and it's amazing. He wrote the songs on it. He sings perfectly, but the whole thing was just like you were saying. I mean, it was like when you talk roots music, Jim. This is roots music. I mean, this is going back to a time where you didn't have anything. So your soul and your talents were what you built on, and it was incredible. It humbled me to the point where I started listening to his music. And then after a little bit, after the first interview where we were talking about, had a lot to do with just being human. And then he got into going to LA and getting his band together and how he was such a perfectionist that no one wanted to work with him because it was like, we got to get this right. You know, and he would have it in his head, Jim, but it was like, we got to play it this way. And it was just such a cool dude. But I totally agree with you. He's right on board with you. Slavery didn't end right at the Civil War. Changed names and kept going.
I can tell you a little bit more about that. I was very fortunate to be trusted enough by the people that owned the plantation that Sonny Boy lived on from age 1 to age 17. And I actually was the one who discovered that. His life was very shadowy, and that's why no one's really written a book about him. It was so hard to research because he was so vague about who he was, where he was born, how old he was, all these other things. And there was reasons for that, and that's another story. But the long and short of it was that this really wonderful family shared with me, and they very luckily had a lot of photos because the lady that was one of the current owners of the property, her grandfather was an amateur photographer, so he just took tons and tons and tons of pictures and snapshots and stuff like that. So most of it was of, you know, the family and stuff like that. But he did take a lot of pictures of the plantation and some of they called the help. And so I was able to find some very incredible shots from Sonny Boy's youth in there. not of Sonny Boy that I could identify, because a lot of them were kind of, you know, small itty bitty snapshots with whole groups of people. So I wasn't, he may be in some of those group shots, but I couldn't identify him. But, you know, just what the life was all about, what the life was that they were doing there. And she shared with me the actual ledgers of how these people were compensated, what the business arrangements were. And basically what it was this, and this was throughout the South. This is throughout that region. And what they did was they paid the adults, you know, $1 a day. And then at the end of the year, they would get a percentage of the what they produced as far as the cotton that they brought in. In their case, it was a cotton plantation, and essentially, from what I could tell, it was dependent upon whether they liked them or not, whether they basically screwed them. They wanted, if they were making a lot, doing really well, bringing in cotton, they would always come up with lots and lots of expenses that they had to pay, and it was illegal for them to leave owing money. And if you were to leave owing money, it'd be like a serious problem. They put out a posse out to come get you and throw you in the county farm, make you in the hard labor until you agreed to come back and work. So it was like a really bad system, and it didn't matter if you were real skilled, whether you were a carpenter or the person that drove everybody to town in the fancy horse and buggy or the car or whatever, or the cook or the person that actually raised your child or all these other highly skilled, people all got paid $1, and their money they made at the end of the year for their Christmas bonus was basically, that was about all it was. It was just enough to have a decent little Christmas and then get back to work. And then, it was essentially slavery. You can see what I'm saying, right? It's just, it was,
right.
You know, they didn't have any control, and there was no way to go to sue, say, I'm owed this or that. You know, they couldn't sue. There was certainly no recourse if one of the white folks were to do something criminal to them, assault or rape or murder or just about anything. There was no recourse. So it was just all about like slavery, and they pulled it off for about 70 years down there until it kind of started unwinding. It's still unwinding today. But where this music came from. I'm glad you brought it up, and it's amazing that Charles Wright, and he sounds like a really interesting cat. He made a lot of great records back in the day, I remember. But long and short of it was, this is where this music came from, and these are the people that originated. I mean, they were the ones that first got electric guitars together from, you know, getting the to do blues, and electric guitars were actually going before then a little bit in the jazz world, but they were the ones that really got it going with this blues based music with that kind of distortion and just all the stuff that we grew up with, you know, that we loved growing up listening to the Beatles and the Stones on. They were doing it way back in the late 30s, early 40s, and they were the ones that started it, and were the innovators.
Yeah, and they influenced like the Yardbirds, the Animals, the Stones, John Mayall, all these guys that we thought, oh, we're finding this really cool new music, because, you know,
right,
it's coming back to us from England. And then,
right,
you know, I've read interviews from them, Jim, where they're saying, what, you guys are from the United States? You haven't heard of these guys? You haven't listened to their music?
Yeah.
And a lot of the kids hadn't. And it was,
cool.
You know.
Let me tell you, yeah, no, nobody had. I've done more research on Sonny Boy probably than anybody else on the planet. And basically, I found like, you know, maybe 10 maximum even mentions that he was even mentioned in an American journal of note or any sort of news organization. And there was never a preview of his show, never a review of one of his shows, never an album review, never an interview, nothing in America. He was not considered important other than magazines like Billboard and Cashbox, where it would be like, yeah, this one's really hot, it'll really kick butt on the jukebox or whatever. And that was the kind of things editorial he got, and period. I mean, the only guy that really did a review of his music was a young guy who ended up becoming Dr. Demento later in life. In his college days, he had a record review, sort of mimeograph little magazine that he and his friends did in Portland. and Oregon, and that was the only one. And there was a couple of mentions in Jet and sort of group articles about the blues guys going over to Europe early on in the early 60s, but that was right near where he died. But I mean, he just never was covered, and it's amazing all the things he did, all those huge songs that he wrote that have been covered by so many people. So it, you know, just getting back to, you know, the you know, to my situation, this has been a tremendous lift to me to do all this research and to really learn so much about the music business and about the history of American music and through Sonny Boy's experience. And it really did help me get this album kind of way I wanted it to be. And I think you made a real good point about what Joe Welch said about the digital music really kind of lose a lot of the soul. I think that's what I did the best I could to make sure that all the songs had soul. Now, a lot of people are going to listen to this and think that it's going to be a blues album or a soul album, and it's really not. It's a rock and roll album, but that's because that's who I am. I mean, I come from sort of a rock and roll background, power pop, glam rock, punk rock, all that kind of stuff. So it is what it is, but it's more the feeling I get and the inspiration that I got from really listening to all this great music and listening to all these great performers that from prior to when I first got really kind of focused on music.
Well, my guest is Jim Bassnight, and his website is jimbassnightmusic.com, and his latest release is Not Changing. Let's play that.
Yes.
Let's play the title track, Jim. And would you like,
cool.
When we come back, we'll talk about the making of the album. I want to talk about
Perfect.
Your songwriting style and how, you know, you
Perfect.
Come up with the songs. I've interviewed a lot of different songwriters, Jim, and get all kinds of different answers when I ask them about songwriting. And I've had some really cool answers. So we'll be right back after this. We'll be back with Jim Bassnight. We'll find out how he writes his songs. And you're listening to Independent Music Showcase. I'm your host, John Darlington. We'll be right back after this.
Some songs that change the world. This song is for those that never want to change.
If I had another life to live, I would not change a thing. It doesn't mean I'm always right, I know. I'm not living in a dream. There's some things I might like to change, like points of view on 6 o'clock news. It ain't all about gangsters and drugs. It ain't all about to be a thug. It ain't all about who's killing who. It's all about you. Another Tommy Rocker, making money, finding flags to wave. With this guitar, you can dig for gold, but can you dig a soul from a grave? There's some big things I'd like to see, like the devil himself on my TV, singing a song. About Clinton and Bush, it ain't all about watching your tush. It ain't all about Muslims and Jews. It's all about me, you. What are we gonna do to change? You're not changing a thing, not changing. These words remain the same, not changing. You're not changing. Another life to live, I would not change a thing.
And we're back with Jim Bassnight on Independent Music Showcase. I'm your host, John Darlington. We are here for till 9 o'clock, and we really appreciate you, Jim, being on the show. This has just been great. We've gotten into some really good things. And
thank you.
I really appreciate that, because when I started doing this show and I started interviewing people and I started thinking, you know, I've heard the word organic a lot, but I really think that works a lot in an interview where I always have notes and I always try to be prepared, but I just want, you know, people to know about you and about where you came from. And I think we've learned a lot about your passion for music and how that you digging up the roots and wanting to see exactly where, you know, why we're here today and why these people, some people that should be superstars aren't. And it's really incredibly interesting to find out about American roots music. So let's start with this album, Not Changing. So what, you know, what started? I mean, it had to come from something, and then from an idea, and then the songs come. Tell us how, like, the genesis of this and how it starts.
Okay. Well, I mean, the songs on this album all came from different sort of places. I mean, you know, some of the songs were songs that were, you know, just old songs of mine that were sort of half written that were never really finished, and I just got inspired to sort of use a piece here or there from a couple different. I've written about 500 songs in my life, basically, and. I put out, this is my 8th album, so we'll be talking about some of my other music eventually. But this album kind of came from, you know, a mixture of older tunes that had never really seen the light of day, some tunes that had seen the light of day but were sort of in a different place, you know, one or two tunes that had a life at some point but were never done or never, for some reason, weren't thought of as important. And then new songs that I just wrote kind of organically from, you know, just my experiences currently. And so I'd say it's a kind of a mixture of all, I don't know, 4 or 5 of those specific circumstances. And that's just the truth. But basically everything that was on there, I did quite a bit of rewriting on, even the songs that used to be songs I performed. I kind of just did a lot of changes. So everything from my perspective is new. So, but I know some of a couple of my friends sort of, I remember that, you know, but really not too many people have said that. And, you know, the key thing is that, you know, I just basically gave this my full attention after I got this kind of this break from the Sunny Boy thing and was able and had, you know, had the opportunity to really focus on tunes. And I put together about 40 songs, actually. It was upwards of 40, I think, and about 40-something songs. And this guy that produced it with me and also played bass on every track and also engineered the album, Gary Shelton, who's one of my best friends of all time, he helped me choose the songs. And we actually did demos of every single one of those songs, just acoustic, guitar, and vocal, just to think about which songs were the best to go and start producing. So we put together a long, you know, quite a few sessions of just recording songs and then listening to them and kind of talking about them and sort of kind of getting up little, you know, note sheets on all the tunes and talking about what, you know, what we can maybe do with produce when we produce them and stuff. You know, and then but when it all came down, it was just real simple to do this thing real basically without a lot of real fancy production, just guitars, bass, drums, and harmony vocals, and that was it, you know. Really not that much else, but that we were thinking about doing keyboards at one point. We were talking about doing some sax, flute, harmonica, all these other things, but when it came down to it, it just made more sense just to do it really simple, straightforward, and like I said, everything was live. There was no click track on any song. Well, one song had a click track. That was the 3rd song of the album, Big Bang. We did that only because there's a couple of challenges with that one, but it sounds pretty real, especially all the guitar stuff I did on the, and then Bruce Hazen, the guitar player, he also played guitar. A friend of mine, Bruce, he plays in the current version of the Moberlys and my band that was together in the 80s. And he came on and played on five tracks, and then also on this other cover song that we did, but that didn't make the album. It was actually a medley of three cover songs. The song that's a medley of a Prince, David Bowie, and a Ray Davies song. And that's going to be on my next album, actually, which is going to be an all covers album. And that's a whole other conversation. But basically, Bruce came in and played on that, and Bruce played great. Bruce really added some extra dimension on the guitar and on all the songs he played on. And then Dave Warburton, the drummer, was just really spectacular, because when you're talking about recording, what we did, here's how we recorded it, John. We recorded acoustic guitar, vocal, like a scratch vocal, some of which we used on the album, and bass at the same time, and no click track, no drummer, no, you know, band, just acoustic guitar and bass and a vocal. And that's what we put down first, and we built the tracks from that way up. So there was that, we didn't have a, like a lot of people record drums and bass first, they get a basic track and then they build the song out of that. But I decided I wanted to do it this way and let the song speed up and slow down a little bit and all that, things that naturally happen when you do songs like that live with the acoustic solo kind of approach. And it worked really good. I was really happy with it. It was a lot of work at times, and it was kind of vexing for Gary occasionally, but he really rose to the occasion, and we really got it together.
Well, and I think
also
it's a great album.
Really, it's worth mentioning, I really didn't talk about why it was so hard for the drummer, but the drummer had to be able to go in and really become so well acquainted with the track, with the acoustic guitar and the bass, where he could anticipate where things are going to slow down, speed up, or do little oddball things with as far as time. So for him, it was like, you know, chasing a moving target and having to hit it every single time. And he did a phenomenal job of that.
Wow.
He really did. And so, and then the other guy that really contributed a lot was this guy, Steve Aliment, who I've known for many years. Really nice cat, got a great voice. He's got a great band in Seattle called Denny Glane, and they play around with him and his cousin Jack at Johnson, and they basically have great voices together. And I was originally thinking get both of them on there and have sort of a three-part harmony thing going on, but Jack is real busy at work and working like 5/10s or something like that, or whatever it is. He's worked so many hours. And so it would have taken us too long, but Steve came in and did it. And as it turns out, it was just perfect, because I ended up doing a lot of harmony vocals too, mostly the low harmony stuff, and then my lead stuff. And then Steve sang all the higher stuff than me, and he did a really great job. And so that was a real big contribution. And then the only other guy that worked on it besides those guys is a guy named Jay Phillips. And he did that kind of DJ intro on the first song you played, mm-hmm. Living the Way I Want. That was kind of, because he's a DJ in Seattle. And so the idea was to sort of recreate the vibe of, like, you know, AM radio, like when we were kids, like with the transistor radios, and the way the DJs would talk and tell you what's going on in town, blah, 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 before the song goes in. I just thought that was a cool way of introducing the song, you know?
Well, let's talk a minute about one of my favorite things, Jim, to talk about is gear talk. And what guitars did you use on this album? And then go back to talk about, you know, when you were first playing in your first bands and how you progressed through your various guitars and amps.
Okay. Yeah, okay, absolutely. Well, just to start with, which one do you want to go with first?
Let's start from the beginning, when we first started playing.
Oh, boy. Okay, first started playing, had like just a cheap six-string guitar, acoustic guitar, and put a peace sign on it and one of those flower decals, and started playing Bob Dylan and Beatles songs and that kind of stuff. And I learned, you know, Creedence. And I was, you know, I started getting into a little bit of the harder stuff, which at that time was like the Kinks and like the Yardbirds and, like in Seattle, of course, the Sonics and the Raiders and that kind of stuff. So that was my first musical era, when I was just a little kid playing the guitar and trying to learn how to play those songs, or at least to, you know, do the ones that I could play, like Gloria and that kind of stuff, Dirty Water, The Witch by the Sonics, all those kinds of tunes. So then from there, I really didn't do much for a while. I was real heavy into school. I was playing basketball. I was, you know, playing chess a lot. I was doing a lot of other stuff from, like, pretty much You know, I was listening to records a lot, but I wasn't really that into music for a number of years. But I started really getting back into music heavy in the early 70s when glam rock came in. I thought that was really good, and I really enjoy all that, those bands like T-Rex and David Bowie and Alice Cooper and Iggy, of course. Iggy's one of my all-time favorites, and Lou Reed. And Slade and all those bands were just my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
And me and a bunch of my friends got into all that stuff together, and the Image, and we got sort of started thinking about actually the band that really changed it for me was the New York Dolls, because it was so straight ahead rock and roll, and we could play it and we could stomp and scream it out and whatever. And so what we did was we got this band together called the Lover Boys, and it was kind of from that New York Dolls song. Trash, or goes, how do you call you Lover Boy? Which of course is Love is Strange, And so, we were the Lover Boys, and we did all that kind of music, the covers, And I went out and got an electric guitar. Although I was the lead singer, and because I wasn't considered to be that good on guitar compared to my friend Paul, and so he was the guitar player, and I was the lead singer. And probably because I had hair like Mark Bowl, and that's probably why I was a little scared. So I did that. So then from there, I went and got a guitar, and because I wanted to play guitar, but I was really at that point I was starting to really get into, because I don't know if you remember this magazine, like Rock Scene magazine and Hit Parader and stuff like that. They were talking about the New York rock scene really early on, and there was a guy from Seattle that had lived out in New York in the early 70s, and he came back to Seattle in the mid 70s, and he'd been really tight with the Ramones and of course that whole kind of New York scene. His name was Tomato Duplenty, the late Tomato Duplenty, and he sort of turned us on to all that stuff that was going on at CBGB's, like really early, like the New York Dolls, and not that we knew about the Dolls, but I mean the Ramones and Talking Heads and Television. And then when Television released their first record, that Little Johnny Jewel single, I got that. And at that point, that's when I really decided I had to be a guitar player, because I just loved that guitar sound. And so I got that, went out and got a Jazzmaster, which was the guitar that Tom Verlaine played. And I've had that same guitar ever since. It's been since 75, and I bought that guitar. And it was really weird. It was kind of almost serendipitous, because the guy that sold me the guitar is one of my best friends, even to this day. He just decided at that time that he didn't want to be a rock star. I guess by magic inherited that role in life.
Wow.
So basically he sold me that guitar, that Jazzmaster, which is a 61 Jazzmaster, with a 5-digit serial number. And he sold me an amp, which was a 412 cabinet that somebody made, but it had pretty decent speakers in it. And also an acoustic 150 head. I don't know if you remember those things. They're better for bass than guitar, because they're just really loud. Just crank them way up. And then they're transistorized. Mm-hmm. And then like, fuzz box and a wah-wah pedal and a microphone and a mic stand and a zillion cables and all this other stuff. He sold all that to me for $125. He's, I don't want to be a rock star anymore. But he became a computer guy, like an IT guy, and he's doing fine. We're still really good friends and stuff. His name's Ron Bailey. So yeah, he sold me that for $125. So I just took that stuff on, and at the same time, I started writing songs, because I was real inspired by – see, the problem with me is that I never thought I could sing, because back in the 70s, it was like all about these really high screeching singers, like, like that guy from Boston, or he was even before Boston came out. But you know what I mean? Like those really high singers like Robert Plant, all that really high singing. And, my voice really wasn't like that. So – but when I heard Lou Reed – that just changed my life, because here's a guy that I could sing just like that and be as cool as that, So I just started. So I heard Lou Reed and the Velvets and Television and all this stuff. And of course the Dolls were really simple, straightforward, and the Stooges and all that kind of, and I just thought to myself, this is something I can do, because these guys are crazy, but so am I, and these guys are not like big show off technical people. It's all about the feel and all about this kind of real unique view of rock and roll. And so I kind of took it from that point. And I'm sure I'm not the only one. I know a whole generation of kids that came up from that same thing. But basically that's what inspired me to start playing the guitar. And I started playing the guitar, and I started trying to get those weird sounds like Tom Verlaine and Lou Reed in Velvet Underground and all that kind of stuff. And had this band, early band called the Mice. And we played the first self-promoted punk rock show on the West Coast, actually, according to historians, on May 1st, 1976. And that was called the TMT Show. And that was with this guy. I told you it was Tomato Duplantis. He had a band later called the Screamers in L.A. They moved down there. They were called the Tupperwares then. And another band called the Telepaths. And the Telepaths included Bill Rieflin, who was in REM more recently. And he's with Robert Fripp or King Crimson now. But he also played in Ministry. And so he was in a few pretty big bands of note and a couple other musicians that did some cool stuff in that band, the Telepaths. But at any rate, we did this show. It was kind of sort of opened things up, got a lot of press from the local media. It was kind of a big deal. And it kind of went from there. And the Mice was my band, M-E-Y-C-E. And we were together for about a year until – I think it was March 77 is our last gig. And that was when we opened for the Ramones in Seattle. The first time the Ramones played in Seattle. So that was at what was called the Olympic Hotel. Now it's the Fairmont Olympic Hotel. And they got pictures of the show or whatever in the lobby. It's
a big
fancy hotel for people from out of town stay and pay, you know, huge money to stay and stuff. But it's sort of a historic show. And we opened for the Ramones. And then I moved to New York City and lived actually on couple of pretty steady places for a number of months. I once went the road manager for Ramones, kind of took pity on me and let me stay at his loft while he was on the road for Ramones. I'd stayed there for a couple of months and lived with a couple other unique folks. This lady who died, unfortunately, from France, named Lizzie Mercier de Clou. She and her boyfriend had a lot, kind of an artist loft that they let me crash out in. But I got a chance to see all those great bands in New York that I had, you know, become so
awesome.
Fond of over the couple of years before that. Like I saw the Heartbreakers, probably one of the high points. I saw Television, and I saw so many bands, Suicide, you know, The Damned, The Dead Boys. I mean, all those bands. I saw almost all of them. The Cramps. Before they were really even had a record, I don't think. Yeah, saw a lot of bands. So then from there, I came back to Seattle. I was real inspired by that whole experience and to put out my own record, because it was the whole thing was putting out your own little 45 and the punk 45s and all that. And it was going all over the world. And I just put mine out, and I did. And it was kind of known as the first one in Seattle. I had a single called Live in the Sun, and the flip side was She Got F-word, but actually spelled out. And then that was in late 1977 that came out. Actually came out in the street probably early 1978. The date on it, 1977, and that was sort of known as the first punk single in Seattle. But there was one other that was out like a couple weeks before mine, because I know that because the guy that played the drums on my single promised to let me to let his single come out first, which I did. So, but I think it was like a week before, and that was The Snot. So, and that was Drake Eubanks, that drummer. But nonetheless, we did that, and then from there, I got the Moberlys together. By a year later, the Moberlys were starting to play. We played a lot of pretty big gigs. Open for the Police, the first time I played in Seattle. Open to play to the Paramount, which is a big theater in Seattle, two times, and I played there one other time. At a private party in that time frame, and then, you know, just that kind of stuff, just playing, getting some notoriety in the local media, getting a little bit of notice in the national kind of underground media. And then the band put together a sort of an album, but then we broke up. It's just all that kind of stories. I mean, we could go on and on forever, but I was still playing that Jazz Master. I had gotten a different amp by that time. I got a Sound City amp, which was a big, huge amp and kind of loud. And so I didn't really dig that. So after that band kind of broke up and all the stuff that we had recorded turned into this album called the Moberlys' first album. It was, I went out and bought a Fender Pro, which is kind of like a twin, you know what I mean? The Fender Pro.
Right.
And, and that was easier to manage and stuff. And it had a master volume and all that kind of stuff. And so that's what I was using for a number of years. And the Moberlys album did pretty well. Got picked number, I think, 3 underground record of the year by Trouser Press magazine, and got written up in New York Rocker and a bunch of other things, Bomb and just a variety of other people reviewed it, and a couple of people in Europe took notice of it, and it was sort of kind of a cool thing. So Seattle wasn't any kind of a big deal back then, and so I moved back to New York in 1980 after kind of working for a year in a working band in Seattle with my jazz master, my Fender Pro, and saving the money. And I moved to New York City again in the fall of 1980, and then lived there for like 3.5 years and bounced around, played with a lot of people, played with Johnny Thunders a little bit, played with this lady that later became my wife, Ann Dion, and in her band. And she was real, well, actually had been Alan Vega from Suicide's longtime girlfriend. And so I became good friends with Alan and just a lot of other musicians. And I put together a version of the Moberlys with New York members. And then one of the guys, I used to go back to Seattle. In fact, I brought the New York Moberlys back to Seattle to play a gig one time. And one of the guys from Seattle I grew up with, Dave Drury, who unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago, I got him to come out and play drums in the band out in New York, and he came out there, and eventually we decided we wanted to play together, but he couldn't really hang in New York. So I went back to Seattle and formed a new version of the Moberlys with two local guys in 1984. And that was Glenn Oyavi and Toby Kyle. And then that band was together from 1984 until 1989, basically, and did a lot of things. And we ended up moving to L.A. a year later in 85, and were there, you know, from 85 to 89 until we broke up. And there's an awful lot of stories in between and all of this stuff. But I pretty much still had that that pro into when I moved to L.A., I got a Mesa Boogie, you know, those kind of amps.
Okay.
Mesa Boogie, yeah. And so that was that was pretty cool. And then I also started doing acoustic gigs. I got this gig at this place called the Soundcheck in Hollywood, doing like a kind of like a jam night or an open mic thing, and it was cool. There's a lot of music people from LA and kind of the scene there that would hang out and stuff like that, and I met a lot of fun people. And I ended up getting this acoustic guitar, the 6-string acoustic guitar to just do that jam night with. And then it was like a Yamaha or something, or it might have been an Ovation, plug-in Ovation. But then after the Moberlys broke up, I ended up getting a job as a stockbroker, which is a really long story in and of itself, but I saved enough money. I made some pretty good dough eventually, but I was making enough money where I bought myself a pretty nice acoustic 12 string in probably 1990. And that guitar I played about 5,000 gigs on. And unfortunately, when I was doing some research with Sonny Boy down in Memphis, it got stolen out of my rental car out of the airport hotel I was staying in. I thought had really good security, but luckily the insurance for the people I was working for paid for me to get a brand new one. So I got the same kind of guitar now. It's just a new model. So I totally lucked out with that. It's an Ovation Elite model. I don't know if you know those, but it's a real nice like 12 string. And that's what I used on the album, too. I didn't want to use a fancy wood guitar like a Martin or a Taylor or something like that. I just really got the right kind of sound with that same guitar I use on all my gigs. And just cleaned it up and got some good strings on it and did it. And I still have the same jazz master. I've been playing it to the very same day. I've just played, I don't know how many, 1,000 gigs, but I'm sure more than 5, that's for sure.
Well, so, Jim, it's been great talking.
10
yeah.
or at least. yeah, go
yeah,
ahead.
We're running out of time, and I can feel my psychic abilities that we need a Jim Bastnight part 2. We definitely need that. So.
I really dominated the conversation. I warned you. I warned you.
No, it's
you,
great.
You
I love every
minute
of it.
Well, I do
I love
too,
every
John.
Second
it's
of
really
it.
Nice. So this
well,
is
thank
great,
you
man.
So
let's,
much.
Let's do it again. We'll come up with something, and I would love to do this. I'm going to really look forward to getting this out there. Thank you very much.
And go to jimbastnightmusic.com. His latest album is Not Changing. It's really good. It's well worth it. I love listening to it. Jim, I wish you all but the nothing but the best, and we'll talk to you later. And I want to thank everybody that supports independent musicians and that has supported this show for the last 11 years. We really appreciate it. So everybody have a great evening. Thanks
take
a lot,
care.
Jim. We'll talk to everyone later.
Thank you so much. Good night, man.
Good night.